It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show. You can join us during the week on Fox Business TV, 4 to 5 p.m. every day. Name of the show is Kudlow. And if you can't make it at 4, you can just text your favorite 9-year-old and she'll show you how to DVR the show. And here on the radio, you can live stream us on the internet, LarryKudlowShow.com, LarryKudlowShow.com, all around the country, throughout the world, and the solar system, including the Milky Way. So we're trying to cook up Senator Kevin Cramer, North Dakota, trying to find him out there. Maybe it's too cold. Maybe the electricity went down. Who knows? I want to talk about, while we're waiting, this article by Bret Stephens in the New York Times, which I mentioned with Mark Simone and Joe Concha. I know Bret down through the years, very smart guy, a conservative, certainly a foreign policy hawk. All right, we got John McIntyre on the line. He's going to bail us out. John, head of...
Larry.
Wait a second. I don't get this right. Go to my sheets. John McIntyre, president and CEO of Real Clear Politics and Real Clear Media. And this is going to be a really hot website. It's always a hot website, but now in full swing in the election season. And I've known John a long time. John, thank you. I'm glad you're around. We couldn't find Kevin Cramer. Maybe we'll find him. Maybe we won't. So, John, I'm looking at the polls, Real Clear Politics, Iowa, and New Hampshire. One thing I wanted to ask you, there was this St. Anselm's poll out for New Hampshire, which I saw in Real Clear Politics this morning, which showed, if nothing else, Haley's momentum, so-called, quote-unquote, Haley's momentum seems to have stopped. Actually, I think she lost a point, and Trump picked up a point relative to last month in December. How do you read that story in New Hampshire?
I think that St. Anselm poll, the way you describe that, is probably somewhat close to the reality on the ground there. Mm. I think Haley definitely had momentum there going into the end of last year. You know, so November, December, rolling into New Year's, and she clearly, you know, had moved, you know, completely into second place. You know, Trump was under 50%, so I think she had pulled to within 20 points. You know, the question is, you know, you had a CNN poll that showed it 39-32, but then you've got a poll by Suffolk for USA Today, and Suffolk's has a pretty good polling record during the exact same period of time, and they had the race 46-26, 20 points. So, you know, the Real Clear Politics average has it at 14 right now. That's, I think, about where it is, a 15-point Trump lead. So I think that's where it is. I think the pro-Haley side is hoping for a second place in Iowa and then to kind of take that and build momentum from that to try to make it close and maybe, you know, pull off an upset in New Hampshire.
I think she hurt herself in that debate. Actually, I think both she and DeSantis, but I think she hurt herself a lot. I mean, that debate was, you know, John, they just killed each other, frying each other's brains out. And here's Trump taking the high road, right? With Bret Baier and Martha McCallum on the Fox Town Hall. First of all, getting at least twice the number of eyeballs. But Trump taking the high road, no retribution. We're going to have successes. A lot of good answers on abortion and so forth. And the two of them killing each other. I don't know. I mean, I think Trump was a big winner. The Daily Mail poll showed Trump as a big winner for the whole event. I mean,
well, yeah, no, I mean, in some ways that night was like a microcosm of the whole primary to date.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's really, it's been for a long time now a battle for second.
Mm.
Okay, and Donald Trump has effectively run a campaign as an incumbent president. And I mean, you saw that. In a truly competitive primary, in a truly competitive contest before the Iowa caucuses, you would not have a situation where the leading candidate just was not participating in the debate. I mean, and particularly, you know, Trump's performance on Fox on that town hall just seemed very relaxed, very comfortable. Like, I think he knows he's clearly in control, in command, is going to be the nominee. So when we talk about Haley momentum and all these things, what we're really talking about is just how quickly the nomination gets wrapped up. If Haley gets a strong second, she does well in New Hampshire. Yeah, maybe this can kind of continue on into South Carolina in two for Tuesday, but Donald Trump's going to be the eventual Republican nominee. So it's just a question: does it go out into Super Tuesday in a little longer, or does Trump have a big win Monday night? Does he follow it up with a win in New Hampshire, and this thing's effectively over?
I'm assuming, John, and I don't follow this as closely as you do, but Trump has organization nationwide. He's, you know, lots of states. I don't, you know, he's got big shots. He's got, you know, governors, senators, House members. And for example, Florida, Nevada, he's got people endorsing him, you know, big names endorsing him. In other words, does Haley and or DeSantis have the kind of national operation that Donald Trump has?
Yeah, and it's not just national operation. Trump's at 60%. He's at 61% of the Real Clear Politics national poll average. Mm. I mean, he's got well over 50% of Republican voters who want him to be the nominee. And you know, DeSantis, even if he surprises and does a little better in Iowa Monday night, like, he's in fourth or fifth in New Hampshire. He's doing terribly there. There's nowhere he's going to go to. And so, like, that's not really a real threat to Trump. And the thing is with Haley, you know, Haley has a ceiling at some point. Like the major, you know, if it gets into a two-person race, okay, the major, you know, more Republican voters prefer Donald Trump than Nikki Haley, overwhelmingly. So, and that's your point about nationally, like, Trump's lead is just, it's too large. He's well over 50%. He's been over 60% for some time now. That's why it gets back to my point. It's like, I think, you know, the New Hampshire result, you know, in 10 days is interesting, but it's interesting only as so much to how quickly Donald Trump wraps up the nomination. And that's important because in a general election context, the sooner the Republicans can decide on their nominee and get behind them and work to get the party unified, that's going to increase their chances of winning in the general election.
John, going into Iowa and New Hampshire, in the Republican side, biggest issue in your judgment, single biggest issue is what?
Well, even though I would say it's the economy, I really think so. I mean, obviously, people talk about the border and the illegal immigration issue, but I think the economy is what drives voters at the end of the day, and I think that's what's really redounding to Donald Trump's benefit. People remember how things were 4 years ago before COVID came, And I think, in many ways, you know, that's Trump's strongest asset right now, is that they remember where the economy was, they remember how their personal finances were, their kitchen table issues, and then the other thing in the news is just all the chaos going on in the world. Everything we see in the Middle East, the Ukraine thing, none of that was going on 4 years ago, when Trump was president. So. I think, you know, the single biggest issue is people's pocketbook issues. You know, maybe the illegal immigration border issue second.
All right.
For Republican voters.
John McIntyre is president and CEO of Real Clear Politics and Real Clear Media. You got to go to Real Clear Politics every day, folks. There is more information and articles and polling data. It's so important. John, thank you. We appreciate it very much, buddy. Folks, take a quick break. And, yeah, we did find Senator Kevin Cramer in the wilds of North Dakota or someplace. So we're going to take a quick break, and Kevin Cramer will be with us on the other side. Straight ahead. Stay with us, please.
This is the Larry Kudlow Show. Now, back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. So now we found Senator Kevin Cramer from the great state of North Dakota. Welcome back, Senator Cramer.
Well, it's good to be back. It's also good to be back in North Dakota, even though the temperatures are well below zero. That would be below 0 degrees Fahrenheit. Let's just say the air is fresh.
Global freezing. Where's John Kerry now that we need him? Global freezing. Invite Kerry to North Dakota so he can understand why global warming emergencies are a hoax.
Oh, boy, would that be good. But John Kerry only goes to convenient locations with convenient messages.
Oh, all right. Senator, I wanted to we're not going to have as much time as I'd hoped. But look, the U.S. and Britain hit the Houthis. I don't know what good it did or what good it didn't do.
Yeah.
I'm just reading, looking at the Fox News website, Turkey just hit Syria and Iraq. Now, they're going after the Kurds. That's an ancient rivalry. Yeah. But there are oil fields that were hit. And the Red Sea, mm-hmm. To some extent could be about oil. But oil prices haven't really moved. They spiked a little yesterday, and then they came back down. How do you read this whole story? I mean, oil just doesn't seem to want to move.
No, I mean, oil's at a pretty good price right now, but and if it would stabilize there, and then we'd have probably plenty of production and plenty of demand. But I think for now, there's the demand is down and it's uncertain, and the supply is up pretty high. So, short of a more major event in the Red Sea and somewhere in the Middle East. Or perhaps some sort of a major storm, even in the Gulf Coast. It seems to me that oil is sort of stable for now, and that the investors are laying back to see what the near term and midterm future holds. I expect that demand is going to go up, Larry, and that there'll be an increase in price. But if there's a major event in the Middle East, a major Red Sea event, and by the way, that raises the issue of why we have a strategic petroleum reserve, not so that Joe Biden can try to manipulate price for his political gain. But anyway, another topic. But short of, I think that if there's a major event like that, you could see it, you could see $90 to $100 oil again. But none of us are hoping for that, quite honestly.
Did this Houthi attack come to anything, to mean anything? I was talking to Robert O'Brien, former national security.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, he said we hit a bunch of mud huts, but unless we go after Iran, we haven't done anything.
So I think that's the fundamental problem, Larry. For one thing, we don't even respond until there have been about 10 or more attacks on one of our, installations. And even then we try to respond in a way that's more timid than the original attack. So until we go after the head of the snake's just going to continue to do what the snake does. And so I'm not advocating, an assault on Tehran tomorrow or anything like that, but clearly what we're doing is not a deterrence at all. I mean, there's a wonderful North Dakotan laying in Walter Reed Hospital right now. It's, an ICU because of what's going on in the Middle East. We're saddened by that. And yet the response hasn't done anything compared to what they're trying to do to us. So I don't think it's been adequate, Larry. I think most of us think it hasn't been adequate, and certainly Robert O'Brien would know more than most of us combined would know about it. Remember, I mean, you were in the White House with Donald Trump. We didn't have these types of problems with Iran. They knew, you know, who was in charge. They had a respect and a fear for the commander-in-chief, and right now we have a commander-in-chief that doesn't even know where his Secretary of Defense is half the time. So I just... It's dysfunction and it's unserious, and we need to get a lot more serious.
The Lloyd Austin story, I mean, everybody wishes him well in terms of his medical problems.
Of course
we do. But other than that, it's a very bad story. And, you know, begs the question, who's making these decisions? I mean, is the Defense Department making these decisions? Hard to know. You got junior staffers at the National Security Council making these decisions? Does Joe Biden know about these decisions? I mean, there are wars out there in Ukraine and the Middle East, and there's, you know, side wars with the Ukraine and Houthis and Hezbollah. They're not such side wars, but they're not the main war between Israel and Hamas. But the point is, what does Biden know, and who's running this thing?
Well, for sure. A couple of things come to mind. First of all, there's a wonderful interview with Leon Panetta, of course, former Secretary of Defense and former White House Chief of Staff for Barack Obama. And he lays it out pretty well. And one of the points he makes, and obviously he doesn't trash the Democrats, but one of the points he makes is that there's too much of a concentration of power inside of the White House. And I think that's exactly right. When you don't even miss your Secretary of State or your Secretary of Defense for a week at the hearing, at the briefings, you know, that says something. But when your Secretary of Defense doesn't feel it's important to let the Commander-in-Chief know that he's in the hospital or incapacitated, that says something about the Commander-in-Chief or at least the regard they have for that person. So it's hard to say which end of this value chain is the most messed up. But the reality is that, to your point, the world is as dangerous today as it's ever been in my lifetime. And we need a commander-in-chief and the Secretary of Defense and a whole bunch of other people, Joint Chiefs of Staff, and right on down the line to be on top of their game. And right now it appears they're barely in the game.
Last minute, Senator Kramer, in Taiwan, the nationalist won, Vice President Lai Ching. He's not the guy Beijing wanted, which means he's the guy we wanted. Right. How do you read that quickly?
Well, first of all, very good for Taiwan, very good for the United States, and I think very good for the world. And as important as who won that election is the fact that they have a free and open election. Mm. And that's important for freedom-loving Americans to understand as we look at the geopolitical challenges in front of us. And once again, whether it's military or statecraft or trade, energy, this was a good victory in lots of ways.
That's a great point. No, the democracy point is a terrific point. Senator Kevin Kramer, we appreciate it very, very much. Be well. Folks, we'll take a quick break. And on the other side of the break, you know what? We still have inflation. We're going to talk to John Carney of Breitbart Economics. I'm Kudlow. We'll be right back.
From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We still have inflation problems. And I think this idea that the Fed is going to be slashing its Fed funds target rate multiple times this year may prove to be a bad bet by the bond market. But let's bring in John Carney, Breitbart Economics Editor, and co-author of the Breitbart Business Digest, which is a must-read. John, welcome. You know, I'm looking at some of the stuff you've got. First of all, my pal Rick Santelli, who's a wonderful guy, it takes $1.19 in 2023 dollars to buy what a dollar bought pre-COVID. That's an interesting point. 19 cents. Inflation
is very important because it reminds us to look at inflation, not just as what happened last year, but what's happened to us over quite a few years, because that's how it impacts households and families.
No, that's right. That's exact. Is it right? You know, it's funny. We always think of it in terms of under Biden, so you could base it January. So the CPI is up about 17% since January of 2021. Maybe we should be basing it from the end of 2019.
I think that's probably correct. I personally, I think CNBC didn't let him do it just Biden, but just Biden's term, and that's why he did it 2019. But there is, you know, they said, no, it's too political. Yeah. But 2019 for a lot of people was the last normal year. So I do think that makes sense. By the way, there was no inflation in 2020. So, you know, it probably doesn't make much of a difference at all whether you start your counting in 2021 or started in 2019. That was the last year people experienced things as normal. And I think that that is when they think about normal prices, they probably have the mindset of 2019, and big deviations from that is what bothers them so much.
You know, don't forget my pal Santelli, who's really a lovely man. He was one of the founders of the Tea Party. Remember?
Absolutely. I watched it live.
Yeah.
The morning that he announced, we're having a Tea Party.
Yeah.
It was pretty exciting, and yeah, he got it going.
I remember that night. I had him on my show, my old CNBC show, just to clarify what he was doing. But it took. Now, your other pieces here. Inflation has been stuck in high gear for 6 months. Now, you wrote an interesting piece on the producer price index, maybe a little technical for us here on the radio. That was a good piece,
though. It's a treatise on the producer price index. Yeah. If anybody ever wants to know, what is this thing and why isn't it the CPI? If you read the New York Times or frankly, any other financial press, you will not find out what it is because none of them know, apparently.
Right.
I read through all the reports. They all got it wrong. I explain what the difference is, and it is too technical to go in here now. But again, if anybody really wants to know what PPI is, they can read last night's Breitbart.
Yeah, no, it's very good. Intermediate demand index, pretty close to what final demand could be. But you're right. You know, you could just look at commodity prices. But anyway, the bone crusher was, when did it come out? Thursday. The CPI was higher than people thought. And I guess your point is, after coming down for many, many months, now it's leveling off, and it's leveling off at close to 4% on core, which is twice the Fed's 2% target. So
that's right. It's the idea that we were on a glide path to 2% really seems to, that's still the market's mindset. It still sees 5 rate cuts next year, which you have to think means that inflation would keep coming down. But we really haven't been, there hasn't been much disinflation happening since last June or July. We're sort of stuck in a holding pattern. And by the way, some people like Mohamed El-Erian, he says, well, the Fed should just target 3% instead, and everything would be a lot easier. You know, which of course it's easier. You know, if my wife tells me, hey, I need you to, you got to get out there and mow the lawn. And I say, well, you know what, I'm just, and I do half of it. And I say, well, that's my target. I was only going to mow half of the lawn. Then the job's done already, right? Like, yeah, it would make things easier, but it would be a disaster. This is the first time the Federal Reserve's 2% target has really ever been challenged, where they, where they went above it and they're trying to bring it back down. To give up on the target now would actually destroy their credibility, because how would the 3% target have any credibility if we know that they caved the first time they had trouble getting it back to 2%?
Well, so you're at 3.4% 12-month change, and core is 3.9%. And then, John, going down services, which includes labor costs more than most of the other categories. So services up 5% last 12 months. Services ex energy up 5.3%. I mean, I'd keep an eye on that if I were the Fed, because, that's a big part of the economy. And nobody else wants to look at it, but they're supposed to look at it. Not look at all the woke DEI classifications. We did a whole segment on that on the TV show, which is the worst thing I've ever seen. But this, inflation, embedded inflation.
Yeah, and so one of the problems right now, and this is why I think that inflation is not going lower and it's probably going to go higher. Maybe January will go a little lower. January is a funky month. But over the next 6 to 8 months, it's not going lower. It's probably going higher. One, we're not going to get any more goods disinflation. We got some of that from the clearing up of supply chains, the repairing of the way things are made, nearshoring items that were made in China. That's not going to, that's over. That progress, you know, that probably took us from 9 down to 5% inflation. Mm. The goods part isn't going any lower. The services part does not seem to be, that was where they needed the disinflation to come from next. If you look at either the CPI or the PPI, there's no sign that services inflation is coming down. And why should it? We have 3.7% unemployment. If you look at jobless claims, they're at around 200,000. That's not coming down. The pressure is not coming down. So we are going to see sustained higher inflation because there's no more goods disinflation, and we haven't been able to achieve a softening of the labor market.
So, you know, from all this, I think the bond market bet, the futures market, that you're going to have, I don't know, 5 rate cuts or maybe more. I don't know what the latest is. The Federal Reserve itself, with their economic projections.
The Fed has
projections.
3 penciled in now. Right. The market has 5.
What the heck? How can you do that with these kinds of numbers?
I think both of those are wrong. I think right now, unless we get something super unexpected weak happening, I can't see them really cutting in March, even though the market thinks there's a 60 to 70% chance of that happening. I think they're going to aim for a May cut. The May cut could get derailed if inflation starts to pick back up, which I think it will. But so they try to cut in May. Maybe they cut in March, but I don't think that the 5 cuts the market has in is realistic. And I think they may even have trouble getting 3 cuts in. I think it may be a one and done. Mm. They cut rates, see what's going on in inflation, see that it's picking back up and say, okay, we can't do that again. They are at risk of repeating the mistakes of the 1970s, where the Fed kept thinking that they had defeated inflation, cutting rates, and then having to raise them even higher than they had gone before because inflation took off again.
And John, I think, you know, if the Fed starts cutting rates before they hit their 2% target, the risk of politicizing the Fed, they're going to get called out on it by Republicans all over the country, and including myself. Now, I have a counter view here. I think Jay Powell is going to be stronger than some others think. I don't think he want. First of all, I don't think he wants to be renominated for a third term, and I think he understands the politics very, very well, and he knows that if he starts cutting rates and the actual inflation is still above target, you know, he'll be accused of juicing the economy to reelect Joe Biden. I don't think Jay Powell wants that.
He doesn't want it, and there's no reason for it. There's not a the unemployment's at 3.7%. There's no compelling reason to cut. Mm-hmm. So why take the risk of having this immense, possibly institutionally threatening backlash that will come? Remember that the Fed's dual mandate is set by legislation. Congress put that in place in the 1970s. It can be changed. Congress can control the Fed without interfering with its independence. I'm not saying Congress should set monetary policy, but they could tell the Fed, for instance, you know what, you have to target 2%. And you cannot cut rates when you're above 3%, right? Mm-hmm. They could just pass a law, or they could take away the employment mandate altogether and say, your only job, the ECB has one mandate, your only job is price stability. And I don't think the Fed wants Congress to start passing laws that restrict the Fed's actions. And that's really what they're risking if they get political.
That's what'll happen
when they don't need to.
You'll get guys like French Hill on the Banking Committee, Financial Services Committee. They'll jump all over it. So I agree with you. So, folks, John Carney, Breitbart Economics Editor and Breitbart Business Digest every day. You got to follow this thing. It's the best product of its kind. John, thank you ever so much. Folks, we'll take a quick break, and then the great Roger Stone, political analyst supreme. All right. He's going to come in and give us some of his wisdom on Iowa, New Hampshire, and the entire race. I'm Kudlow. Roger Stone up next.
Larry Kudlow. Now, back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow, and we're going to talk to Roger Stone, longtime political consultant and strategist to a number of campaigns, going all the way back to Richard Nixon. He is the host of WABC Radio's The Roger Stone Show, Sundays from 4 to 6 p.m. And his website is stonecoldtruth.com. Roger, welcome back. Happy New Year. We talked earlier in the show about this. I want to get your take on it. I think that Donald Trump had a terrific night Wednesday at the Fox Town Hall meeting. I think Haley and DeSantis, particularly Haley, had a terrible night, beating each other up to death. I think Haley's momentum, if she had any in New Hampshire, has stopped. I think Trump's momentum has intensified. And I think he's going to take Iowa and New Hampshire comfortably. Now, that's my view. You know more about politics. Tear it apart. Go on ahead.
Well, I think, Larry, you're essentially right. First of all, 5.3 million people watched Trump's town hall on Fox, where fewer than 2.3 million people watched the slugfest between Haley and DeSantis on CNN. Secondarily, new polling, late polling, kind of final polling, shows Trump finally breaking the 50% barrier. He's at 53 in the big data poll, with Haley and DeSantis in a head-to-head 17-17 dead heat for a distant second. The weather is extraordinarily inclement. It's very cold, but Donald Trump is not making the mistake that Ronald Reagan, the last great tax-cutting president we had before Donald Trump, made in 1980 by leaving Iowa early. In fact, despite the bad weather, Trump intends to fly in tonight into Iowa and stay there through the caucuses Monday night. So he's taking nothing for granted. This is one of those things where people need to understand the difference between a caucus and a primary. You don't just walk in, vote, and leave. You have to sit, you know, in a drafty fire hall or community center or public school or wherever the caucus is being held for an hour to cast your vote. There's far, far more intensity among the Trump supporters. They are deeply dedicated. A blizzard would not keep them away. I think you are right. So the real question will be, Trump will win. The question is, who emerges as a distant second, who will then get the media buildup? I mean, I can see, I don't think this will happen, but if Nikki Haley surpasses DeSantis, which is possible, the headline will be Haley defeats DeSantis in Iowa upset, subhead, much smaller letters. Trump comes in first as expected. You can always count on the fake news media.
I think DeSantis can beat her in Iowa. I think she destroyed herself in the last debate. I know hardly only a couple million people watched it. Over 5 million people watched the Trump town hall at Fox. So, yeah, I get that. But I think of those that watched it, and the write-up of it was so bad, Roger, I think it really hurt her.
Look, I agree with that. I think she's fully exposed. Her foreign policy is a pale version of the Biden foreign policy. I think people now get that. She's the uniparty neocon Bush candidate. I called her on my show Dick Cheney in heels. And I do think DeSantis damaged her, and neither one of them did any damage to Donald Trump. Right. So in this case, I think you are right. Now, she's hoping for an upset victory. She knows that independents can vote in New Hampshire. She has the strong support of the governor there, Chris Sununu, whose father, John Sununu, was once governor. He lied to me and Jack Kemp and Senator Bob Dole for 11 straight months, insisting he had no commitment to George Bush. That was way back in 1980. So skullduggery runs in that family. But I think she's done. And neither one of these candidates has the resources to go to the next round. So I agree with you. I think Trump wins Iowa comfortably on Monday night. I think he will then go on to win New Hampshire comfortably, and then he runs the table. He wins the Nevada, which is now a beauty contest primary, but he also sweeps the caucuses the same day, and then he goes on to win big and finally puts Nikki Haley away in her own home state.
So one thing interesting to me, remember when the so-called evangelical leader, what's his name, Bob Vanderplatz, if I have that right, he endorsed Ron DeSantis. Everyone was talking about how important that was, blah, blah, blah. But it looks to me, and some polling, that Trump is going to win big time among evangelicals in Iowa.
Look, we live in the age of mass communications, and individual evangelical Christian voters are not a flock led by any one person. Mm. They make up their own minds. And Trump did extraordinarily well among evangelicals in Iowa in 2016, despite the fact that he didn't have any of the big name pastors at that time. He didn't have any of the big name evangelical Christian endorsers. Now, Ron DeSantis paid $95,000 for that contribution or that endorsement in the form of a contribution to Mr. Vanderplatz's nonprofit. Some would refer to that as 30 pieces of silver. So I just don't think endorsements matter, with one exception. I've been in this business 45 years. There's only one political endorsement I've ever seen actually pack a wallop, and that is the endorsement of Donald Trump. If you don't believe me, just ask Governor Ron DeSantis. He could tell you all about it.
Okay. Good. The other thing is, some people are saying, well, Chris Christie had 12% of the vote in New Hampshire. Now, recent polls show it's down to 9. But that's going to transfer to Nikki Haley and give her a leg up and close the gap against Trump. I mean, I think that's baloney. First of all, Christie hasn't even endorsed Haley. He said something nasty about her. She's going to get smoked. But you can't just transfer votes like that. That's not how polls work. That's not how voters work.
Well, I think it is accurate, if you look at the polling, that the choice of most of the Christie voters, the second choice, is Nikki Haley. But the second choice of most of the DeSantis voters is Donald Trump. So if DeSantis and Christie are essentially would be eliminated for the New Hampshire round, Donald Trump gets most of the DeSantis votes, which I think cancels out anything Nikki Haley would pick up from the withdrawal of Chris Christie. And as you point out, Christie has not endorsed her. And then I also think Vivek Ramaswamy, who's very interesting. Actually, he's on my WABC radio show, the Roger Stone Show, tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern. People can listen at WABCradio.com. Great interview. He really, really slams Nikki Haley, because we pre-recorded that due to his tough campaign schedule. But where is he going to come out in this? In other words, I think he overperforms a little bit in Iowa, but not so much that it hurts Trump. And then we have to see what he does in between Iowa and New Hampshire, whether he stays in the race. But those votes most definitely would go to Trump.
All right. Roger Stone, everybody. Terrific stuff. Radio show Sundays, 4 to 6 p.m. Thanks, Roger. Appreciate it very much. Folks, we're going to take a break. Other side of the break, we're going to do some stock market work. I'm Kudlow. Please stay with us.